Services Budget Division is going to just do a little bit of wrap-up work today. We're going to be hearing about the PCA program, the planning that's being done for people that don't have two activities of daily living but might have need for PCA. And then we're going to hear from the Mental Health Division about what's been transpiring regarding the reform of state-operated services. And then I'm not sure if there's someone here from the Department of Veterans Affairs, but we're going to get an update on the situation at Hastings with the veterans' homes. So we'll begin with, it doesn't look like we have the people on the agenda here, so we'll begin with the PCA services if you want to introduce yourself for the members.
Madam Chair, members, I'm Alex Bartolik with DHS.
I'm Lori Dablo with DHS. I'm a supervisor over home and community-based services policy for persons with disabilities. Okay, I'll go ahead and begin then. And if everybody's got the handout, I'm going to probably just follow the order without covering everything in there.
Which handout? We've got one long one, and then we've got one short
one. The one with the little boxes on it.
Okay.
So we'll just take a few minutes and talk about what the PCA changes that are effective July 1st, 2011 are, and then we'll spend the bulk of the time talking about who are the people that are impacted, how we've collected input and ideas from stakeholders, and then lastly we'll go through a list of options for consideration. In 2009 legislative session, there were substantial changes to the PCA program to increase the integrity of the program, simplify the program, and for cost savings. One of those changes was implemented this last year. That was the change in the PCA assessment and access criteria. Currently, right as of this moment, you would require at least one activity of daily living, a dependency and activity of daily living, or a level one behavior to access the program. Now, effective July 1st of 2011, that will change to requiring two dependencies and two activities of daily living, and the level one behavior will no longer qualify. So as part of the planning for that change, the department was responsible for developing alternatives for the folks that would have behavioral challenges and mental health needs. As part of developing the alternatives, we were to consider how we might be able to capture the federal match. And one of those options might be that we would need to discuss would be the 1915I state plan option. Now, to begin the whole process of figuring out what would be those alternative services, of course, we looked at reviewed data, and we kind of carved the data into three different distinct groups. So I'm going to spend a little time talking about those groups so that you can get a sense of what we discovered for who those people are. Group A, as you can see if you're following along in the handout, we've got about 750 people, which is about 38% of the 2,000 people. Oops, I want to take one step back. I forgot to mention that this is data on fee-for-service people. We are still working to obtain the managed care data. So for Group A, no dependencies in ADLs or activities of daily living, but having a level one behavior, we found that this really was a younger group. 77% are under 21 years of age. More than half are male. A third of the children were receiving intensive mental health services, and about a third of the adults are receiving intensive mental health services. I think another thing to note in here is that there is over 40% of people of color. When you look at the diagnoses on the next speaking point, You can see that attention deficit disorder is the highest occurrence for a diagnosis, and about 80% have a mental health diagnosis. So that was very significant. Group B is a very different group. This group has no level one behavior and has one ADL. We found that this group was a higher percent of adults, higher than 50% were female. Again, we had a significant percent of people of color and a wide range of diagnostic conditions. And I think another significant piece was that people were using their PCA services for some ADLs, for ADLs, but also for what we call IADLs, instrumental activities of daily living, which are probably more similar to what we call homemaker services, which helping with shopping and others. So the group B, as you can see, we've got all the different diagnosis percents that we found. I'm not going to go through theirs. I think one really significant thing that we found was that of the adults, which were the higher percent of the group, that bathing was the top activity of daily living, and with grooming right behind it. For the kids, it was eating. So this group, just keep in mind that group B is different. A and C, you're going to find a lot of similarities. So group C, which we had about 26% of the approximately 2,000 people that we have that are impacted, were again, like group A, younger, more males, a significant number of people of color. And again, we did have about a third of the kids were receiving a concurrent mental health service. A little lower number of adults, 23% in the group C, receiving a concurrent mental health diagnosis. And then for group C, the top diagnosis that we found, again, as in group A, is attention deficit disorder. And then following behind a significant number of mental health diagnoses. Excuse me. And for the top ADL for group C, we showed, because this is a younger group, grooming became probably one of the top ADLs, and bathing. Now, in order to collect our stakeholder input, we had about four different sources for stakeholder input. We had a PCA alternative stakeholder group that we'll talk about in just a minute, and then we also had pulled together some information from 13 counties that were serving 80% of the people affected. We also utilized what we call our expert panel. There's a home and community-based services work group that did some review for on some of the new options. And we also had one of our lead staff was providing refresher training, refresher PCA assessment training across the state, and used that as also a place to gather input from counties. Now, to start with a little bit, provide a little information on what we did with the PCA alternative group. You can see on there that we met regularly for about 5 months. Largely consisting of advocates and providers, and I think we had one consistent county and one or two counties that came in towards the end. We spent our time trying to really talk about reviewing this data. What do we know about these people in these three different groups, and what are those support needs that they are likely to have when they lose PCA services? Spent quite a bit of time reviewing the existing service options and talking about if there were barriers to any of those options, what were they, and how might we resolve those barriers, and identifying any service gaps and recommendations to fill gaps. The next slide or box will show you that what were some of those services, the existing ones that we reviewed. I think there was really a lot of time spent on the adult and children's mental health services. And I think the state plan home health aid was also another one that there was some time spent on. We did talk about the other ones, but those were probably the primary focus. I mentioned before that we had the expert panel taking a look at some the new state plan options. There will be a little more information provided towards the end by Alex Bartolik about the 1950i and 1950k. Our targeting input from counties, as I said earlier, there were 80% that were that had 80% of the counties that had, 80% of the recipients needing alternatives reside in 13 counties. You've got the list of the counties in your handout. We also sent them out some data on the folks so that they could take a look at it. We pulled them together in a meeting, went through all of the data that we had, had them kind of talk about what they knew about the folks, what their thoughts were, and then we sent out a survey. And you can see on the bottom of page 7 what those questions were that we asked in the survey. We were really trying to capture that same information. What are the existing services that could be used by people that maybe they're not accessing right now? Any service gap recommendations that they had? And then I think the last bullet, too, just to note, is that we were asking them for any strategies to support people of different cultural communities to assure that
I think you might have different page numbers than we do, so maybe if you just want to refer to the title of the slide.
I'm sorry. Okay, it was called County Survey Questions. There's a box that I was just going through.
Yeah, that's on our page 10.
We have two slides per page, so just keep it 27.
Okay, County Survey Questions is the title of the box. I'm sorry, can you find that? Okay.
Thank you, guys.
Are we caught up? Should I
We're fine.
We have different
versions.
Sorry,
so.
I thought you had the same one, so I haven't seen that version. I apologize. Have I lost everybody completely?
No, I think we can follow. Just refer to the title of the slide when you
want
us to know where you are.
Okay, well, we're just wrapping up on the county survey questions. We'll move into options under consideration, and then it has the subtitle of existing service options. Counties were one of their recommendations that, and particularly some counties, had experienced success with referrals for an occupational therapist to reduce dependencies for some folks, recommend adaptive equipment. So we included that as an option for consideration. And when you look at the dependency of bathing, I think we thought that was a particularly good one. And then with the next one that we have, the home health aide, if for those folks where the OT, where that really doesn't eliminate the need for dependency, that might be an appropriate service for some of those folks. And that would be really that group B that we talked about. Although it might actually help for some folks in A and C, the ones that was more similar with the behavioral challenges. But we really thought this one might be a very good option.
So if they were using a home health aide, would that just increase another area of the budget, or would there be more limits on that than there has been on PCA in the past?
It would be capturing the federal financial participation,
right.
And I think we thought it would be an appropriate service, but we would have to count in that there would be an increase in home health aid service. Yes.
Okay. And is there any limit on the hours for that for people, or is it whatever?
I'm sorry, actually, the other person who's on the list, Sherry Kunkel, I'm going to check with her for a second. Yes, I mean, it does require a doctor's orders. It would have limited time, and so...
By limited time, what do you mean?
It would be a visit versus hours, and a visit, I think, is generally 1 to 2 hours.
I see.
So there would be limits on that. It would not provide the same number of hours of PCA.
Right.
Okay, and then we have the $50,000 to fund children's mental health. Earlier I mentioned that there was a lot of discussion for the people from Group A and Group C who had the mental health diagnoses and behavioral challenges, that we talked a lot about the more intensive children's mental health service, and there's a behavioral aid service in there, that right now it's pretty recognized that there's one pretty significant barrier, and that is the training. There are providers who... They don't have the ability to create the training that's required. So our discussion has been with Children's Mental Health that for $50,000 annually that they could create that training and increase the access to that service. Other options under consideration, the next box. It was, I think, pretty strongly recommended, too, that as part of this next assessment that we would begin in June of this next year, and, of course, long-term also, that we would really strengthen that process to assure that the public health nurse, when they're assessing the person and it's determining that they are not eligible for PCA, that there's a strengthened process to make sure that they have access to the long-term care consultation assessment to look at other options and mental health services, both children's and adults, and the OT assessments, which I mentioned earlier, and home health aid. That those are some critical pieces that we want to really build into that process to make sure that some of those options are utilized. And lastly, for the existing service options, and this isn't necessarily an existing option today, but I think it's something that we could create, is access to limited funding for a menu of supports, and in particular, homemaking and respite. And we could utilize an existing option that we have right now, something like family support grant. We'd probably have to make it a little bit different than it is today, but it would, you know, provide a framework to use. And we've got on here homemaker and respite because I think recognizing that, you know, a lot of our stakeholders said that, you know, homemaker is a service that really, for that group B, the adults that are tend to be more women with the bathing and grooming, that they are using that service right now for assistance with ADLs, but also for what we call IADLs, which are really homemaker-type services. Assistance. So that service came up pretty strongly, and right now it only exists under waiver funding. I think counties have in the past provided it, but don't have that ability right now. So we thought that might be an inexpensive service.
What do you mean by seeking to secure federal match?
We have not at this moment found a way to capture federal match, but I think we're still looking for options to be able to do that.
Are you hopeful, or do you think it's possible? Or?
I think that it's going to be a challenge for us to do that, but we haven't given up yet.
Okay.
And then the respite, I think we thought too, for the family, the children who have the behavioral challenges, if they're accessing the children's mental health support services, which are much more time-limited and more treatment-focused, without having the PCA service, that maybe respite, a little respite from that funding might be helpful, where the families are learning the treatment of how to support their children using the, you know, behavioral strategies, and that then they could teach the respite providers for that consistency and have that break. So that's what we were looking at for this limited funding. And now I'm going to turn this over to Alex Bartalik to finish the presentation.
Madam Chair and members, we've talked in the past briefly about the 1915I and the 1915K options that are available that would receive federal match, and I just wanted to go through a little bit more about it. This is on the grid, that is the legal size. We have been working with a group of people from our expert panel to try to really understand as much of this as we can and the pros and cons as we're going forward. The grid shows what the current PCA program has available, eligibility criteria, income, and compares that with our current waiver programs, which are under the 1915C authority, and then looking at these two new options that we are considering. The 1915I, which is the third column over, is a home and community-based option that can be available through a state plan. So you don't have to apply for a waiver. It would be an entitlement for people who meet the functional need for that level of service. There have been some changes in the authority for the eye. We can have multiple eyes. We could get a couple different programs based on some specific needs, but once you've defined the functional need for that group of people, anyone who meets that need needs to be able to be allowed to access it. We can target it initially, but at the end of a 5-year phase-in period, it would have to be available to all people who meet those functional needs. There are some differences with income. As you can see, this offers two income limit options. One is at 150% of poverty, and the other one is the using our own income standards for institutional care. As we go around to the back side of this, there is service limitations. It still has to have some type of level of care, some way of accessing this program. There are a range of services that can be made available through that. We can't limit the number of people. We can't limit it to certain parts of the state. We have to create a need-based criteria in order to do it. Minnesota has used Medicaid a lot for our programs, and what we found as we've looked across the country is not many states have tapped into this. The states that have tended to use a lot of state and local dollars for services, particularly mental health services, and so this was a way of obtaining Medicaid reimbursement and match for those services. Because we've done so much through Medicaid, to us it looks as though this would be an expansion of some of the services. So we're still looking at it, and we're still trying to understand some of the different service options, but it does appear that it would potentially expand eligibility. The 1915K is the last column, and we are looking at this. There's been a lot of interest in this option, and it is also called community choice, community first option, and it is an ability to basically look at our PCA program and have it be offering more services. So it can be providing assistance, but it can also do training and helping people learn new skills and keep skills. It can help with technology in some situations. It can also pay for some of the cost of transitioning people as they leave an institutional setting. There are income guidelines here, as you can see. It does use an institutional basis of a level of care in going forward. There is an enhanced federal match of 6% over the regular match level. We don't have any federal guidance yet, so we have just been making assumptions as we look at the language about what this can offer for us. There are some questions about whether or not we can do this in a way that's cost neutral with the current PCA program, but there have been discussions about could this substitute for PCA and meet needs in a different way.
Please continue.
If you have any questions, I'd be happy to answer them, but this is the review of these two options. At this point, we don't have enough information until we see the federal guidelines to know whether or not the K is going to be something that we would be able to do within the budget limits.
And it looks like under the column on the I plan, one of the services that can be included is it PCA?
Yes. So the I and the K both would have options that could substitute for what the PCA program is. The I, one piece I did, as I was talking about the level of need, the 1915 I needs to be available for people who are not yet requiring a nursing facility or other institutional level of care. So that's the expansion area that we have questions about.
Senator Lori.
Madam Chair, Ms. Bartolik, just as far as the timeline again, so July of 2011, coming right up, I mean, these folks aren't going to have services. Are we going to have some decisions on this by that time frame? What's going to happen to individuals on that date specific?
Ms. Bartolik.
Madam Chair and Senator Lori, we do have some options that are current state plan options. So home health aid, being able to look at occupational therapy, there are some options that can be given to people immediately. We are looking at a transition. So between July and December, having people go through a transition, it's not as of July 1st, people are off the program. Having the assessment process begin in June so that we are having a way to meet with individuals. That is what we know we can do. Mm-hmm. The K option is not available until October of 2011. So if this is something that Minnesota chose to pursue, people who are currently on PCA most likely would be eligible for the K. We would have to look at the timelines for that transition in order to match it up with the implementation dates for the K.
And Ms. Bartalik, has this information been conveyed to, you talked about the various stakeholder groups that you had met with over several months. So has this information been discussed with them so that those communities and those individuals and those families know what to expect or how this transition is going to work for those individuals?
Madam Chair, so whether or not the people who are going to be affected know, there may have been discussions during the last set of assessments. We are in the process right now of preparing a notice to go out to people so that they are aware in the next few weeks of what the timing is going to be for this. We do have someone, Sherry Kunkel, who has been out meeting with counties and health plans and helping all of the nurses understand what it is so that they're prepared to be able to answer questions and work within their agency to give the support.
I think it would be helpful to have that same information communicated to Senator Berglund so that as undoubtedly questions come forward to members, we'll have that information.
We can do that.
Senator Lori, anything else? All right. It's a small group today, but it's a good group. thank you very much. We'll move on to item number 3 on the agenda, report from Chemical and Mental Health Services, the Transformation Advisory Task Force. And I'm not sure that the names that I have are complete, so I'm going to ask you to self-identify for the record, please.
Okay.
Welcome.
Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Don Allen, and I'm with the Chemical and Mental Health Services Administration at the Department of Human Services.
Good morning, Madam Chair and members. My name is John Anderson. I'm a supervisor in the Adult Mental Health Division.
Okay.
Please begin.
Madam Chair, the materials that we brought along are those in the white folder. I'll speak about the operations of the Chemical and Mental Health Services Transformation Advisory Task Force. From the PowerPoint printout that's in there, the remainder of the materials will provide some background to the things that Mr. Anderson is going to speak to you about. Following the 2003 legislative session, and actually beginning much earlier than that, there's been an enormous amount of transition in state-operated services as we've become better at serving persons with mental illness out in the community. This has led to downsizing and closure of facilities, an enormous amount of change in state-operated services over the year. Following the 2003 legislative session, we began transitioning SOS hospital resources into smaller local facilities known as community behavioral health hospitals. The goal here was to provide care closer to the clients' homes and natural supports, better align these resources with regional community service infrastructure that lined up with the adult mental health initiatives, and then finally to gain greater federal financial participation. What we found as we turned the decade here then, though, was that a lot of the community behavioral health hospitals were operating at far below their capacity. We had been unable to, at that time, to get CMS to come out and survey and certify for federal reimbursement, a number of them. That's recently changed. At this point, we now have 7 CBHHs in operation under the state, and 6 of them have been certified, and the certification of the Rochester facility is pending. So they've all been surveyed and are in the process of being certified. And then we often find that people in acute care settings, people who are in acute care settings who don't need that level of care, this is especially true in our facility in Anoka, where we typically have is around 30 or 40 people who don't need that level of care who, at any one time that are in that facility. So these are some of the problems that led us to the reassessment of the state-operated service system and the broader service system that are being undertaken by the Transformation Advisory Task Force. The next few slides just kind of show you or refresh you on what statute asked of the task force to accomplish. It really is a very broad, kind of a two-pronged attack, a broad look at the service system and the clientele served by state-operated services, and then also a focus in other legislation on options for the Anoka Metro Regional Treatment Center. And so we're going to divide our presentation along those two lines. The advisory task force, as passed by last year's legislature, was overlaid on top of an existing planning process that was undergone in the underway in the administration. And so we adopted a model based on the model that was taken with the successful mental health action group that happened earlier in the decade. And we decided that we would use the advisory task force as kind of a steering committee for a lot of the other planning work that was being undertaken. This led to a structure where we had a number of work groups that were underway looking at different aspects of the service system. All of these have been reporting into the task force, and the task force has been taking the work of those groups and developing its recommendations from there. The legislature directed us specifically to have at least, I think it was about 26 members on the task force that were named specifically. People like members of certain advocacy organizations, state employee unions, counties, and consumer and family representatives. We also had the ability to add more, and so we added some people from the academic sector, added some additional client, family, and provider representatives. I think we finally ended up with about 44 active participants on the task force itself. As I mentioned, the process here then was for the task force to hear the recommendations of the different work groups. The work groups themselves, identify which proposals to recommend, determine the consensus of the task force recommendations, and then report those back to both the commissioner and the legislature. We anticipate that you'll be receiving a report from the task force regarding both its broader mission and its recommendations on a process for the Anoka Regional Treatment Center within the next 2 or 3 weeks. Let me just give you a work group overview. We had, with the assistance of the task force, developed or had in existence already 7 work groups, and this work group process was an enormous undertaking. I haven't actually tallied it up, but I would believe that there were probably more than 200 people involved in those different work groups. We had representation on these work groups from a number of sectors. I met, a very nice jailer from Kennebec County in the process, just people from all over the state who had a stakehold in this process. So it was very, very interesting. We had settled on 7 work groups in the end with the help of the task force. One was levels of care, access to care, neurocognitive services, housing, transportation, dental services, and child and adolescent services. I would like to just kind of run through them individually and give you some idea or a flavor for what kinds of recommendations are coming out of those work groups. Keep in mind, though, that I'm talking about the recommendations that are coming out of the work groups. The task force is just now in the process of establishing its own take on those recommendations and which ones that it considers a priority. So what I'm telling you now is giving you a flavor of what kinds of things are coming out of the work groups, but it is no way can you at this point assume that those are the same things that are going to be endorsed by the task force. We're just in the process of establishing that now, and that will be available when the report is out. I should also let you know that we're constructing the report in such a way that you'll not only see which of those things had endorsement through a voting process, but you will also get a feeling for what kind of objections or concerns there are, even for those items that the task force actually endorses. So I think that the report will give you a very rich picture of the kind of discussion and the kind of support and concerns that are out there for the different recommendations that are brought forward to you.
And Mr. Allen, if I could, you mentioned the report you thought would come out in 2 or 3 weeks. Is there a date certain? I'm sure that Senator Berglund will be interested to know when she can expect to see that.
Madam Chair, we meet on the 6th, on Monday, to review the voting of the task force. If all goes well and the co-chairs are satisfied that we have a product to go forward, I would expect that we could have the reports available on the 15th of December. If the co-chairs, I'm in a little bit of a position in my work with the task force. I'm staff support to the task force, rather, more so than I am a human services employee. And so I believe that if the co-chairs feel that we don't have a product that goes forward, then we'll have to work to get that work done and on the finalized and on the desk. I plan to get this done in December one way or the other. And if all goes as we hope, I think that we'll have reports available on the 15th of December.
Thank you. Please continue.
Okay. Overview of the work groups. The level of care work group was one of the first out of the chute. It did a broad range of key informants and stakeholders from across the state. As with the other work groups that we had, it was co-chaired by a mix of DHS and non-DHS staff. In the case of the levels of care work group, it was co-chaired by our recently departed director of the Adult Mental Health Division, Sharon Audio, DHS Medical Director Alan Radke, and Dr. Michael Triangle of Health Partners Regions Medical Center. The levels of care work group was looking at recommendations regarding changes and that needed to be made into the more intensive end of the service continuum. Some of the items that are coming forward from that work group for consideration by the task force are taking steps to ensure regional capacity of various levels of acute care that are appropriately reimbursed and able to address the challenging and diverse needs of the people we serve. Some of this work, I think, is very interesting in that they have outlined very well what some of the problems that we have in terms of the capacity and of various kinds of hospitals, the CBHHs, some of the local regional hospitals, some of the metro hospitals, and their ability, by the virtue of their makeup, to address the needs of some of the clients that we're seeing. And this has then implications for regional planning and the distribution of those acute care resources around the state. One of the other recommendations coming forward out of this group is changing the way that providers across the continuum of care share risk and handle transitions between levels of care. There's a strong feeling that we need to get away from this kind of clean discharge, hands off, and then pass it on to someone else, that we need to really have a more shared means of managing clients between levels of care that facilitates better communication and the ability easily for clients to transfer back and forth as their care needs dictate. And then finally, there's a recommendation coming forward around flexibility of funding as being a necessary item in meeting the needs of clients with these diverse needs. Another one of the work groups was the neurocognitive services work group. The neurocognitive services work group was looking particularly at the needs of clients who are served by state-operated services with developmental disabilities and traumatic brain injuries. The group was co-chaired by Erwin Concepcion, a neuropsychologist with State Operated Services, and Dr. Amy Hewitt, who's a senior research associate with the University of Minnesota working in this area. Recommendations from the Neurocognitive Services Work Group include restructuring some policies to support existing housing options like GRH and adult foster care so that they're more aligned with supporting the needs and housing choices of individuals than they are. The feeling was that they're currently better supporting the needs of providers. Another recommendation was to provide supports to caregivers to enable their long-term meaningful involvement in the care of their family and friends, and for increased levels of training and competency in the staff working with this clientele. The Access Work Group was the largest by far of the work groups. I think it had at least 50 members, spent most of its time working in three subgroups that were focused on three different topics, rapid access to psychiatry, collaborative psychiatry, and the delivery of mental health urgent care in the state. This group was co-chaired by three people, Sue Abner Holden from NAMI, Becky Secor, who is from the Beltrami Area Service Collaborative, and Doug Seiler, one of the administrators in state-operated services. Examples of recommendations coming forward from this group, and there are many. One of them that caught my eye was a recommendation to bolster the existing mental health crisis intervention capacity in the state and build on existing shared care models that are being used in the state, especially a nice example up in the Beltrami area, as part of a means of supplying rapid access to psychiatric services that would be available in the office, emergency room, out in the community, and perhaps even into the local jails, as there's another great need there. Another example would be improving the bridge between professionals overseeing inpatient care and those supervising community-based care. A lot of times you have psychiatrists who just specialize on the inpatient side and just work on the community side, and we need to have better handoffs between those professionals. Another recommendation is continuing the work to develop and implement standardized approaches to screening, triage, and assessment services across primary care and specialty care settings, and expanding the role of certified peer specialists on crisis intervention teams. One of the work groups that was put together at the insistence of the task force was a work group on housing. Those of you who followed mental health services know that housing is a constant and critical issue that's kind of perennially taunted us over the years. The housing work group was co-chaired by Jim Behrens from Olmsted County Director, and Dave Schultz, another supervisor, along with John, in the Adult Mental Health Division. Recommendations coming from the housing work group are one, that we focus initially on the housing needs of a focused target population, and this target population closely mirrors that population that frequently finds itself stuck in acute care settings. Second, that we use a recently developed SAMHSA housing toolkit as the basis for planning and development of housing options on a regional basis statewide. And also the continued analysis of housing needs to support expansion beyond that phase one population that they recommended earlier. Another one of the work groups was the transportation work group. And I think it's telling that they quickly renamed themselves the Getting There with Dignity work group. They were looking at, charged with the responsibility to study the ways that emergency psychiatric transportation is currently provided across the state and see what could be done to improve on that. This group was co-chaired by Joyce Pesch, who is a longtime social service director in Grant County. Is that right?
That's right.
Okay. Jim Lukacek, who is a Beltrami commissioner. Beltrami County Commissioner, and my friend here, John Anderson, who is with the Adult Mental Health Division. Some of the recommendations coming out of this group is doing a better job of defining when transportation by law enforcement or ambulance is warranted and when some other form of transportation is a better solution, both from the perspective of maintaining client dignity and from a cost perspective. Second among them, and probably I think one of the most exciting, is that they've provided a pretty clear outline for how we could establish a middle tier option for transportation services that is far less costly than a lot of the options that we rely on now, and certainly I think will be far better for the clients that are being transported. And then another one of the recommendations that is coming out of this group is an idea around ways that we can increase the role for client services staff, certified peer support specialists, and state-operated services in the provision of transportation services. So a lot of good work done there, too. Another one of the groups that was put together related to the what was a controversial area in the session last year was the dental services, the dental clinics provided by state-operated services. The dental services work group was co-chaired by Rod Kornrumpf, who's an administrator with oversight of those clinics in the state-operated services, and Patrick Lloyd, who is the dean of the Minnesota School of Dentistry at the U of M. Recommendations from this work group include a recommendation to conduct a comprehensive assessment of dental needs in the state, establish a clear role for the state-operated services dental clinics, which includes their use as training sites, and exploring the potential for a multi-service clinic site that offers dental primary care and behavioral services, kind of a one-stop shop for the clientele that those serve. Finally, we have the Child and Adolescent Intensive Services Work Group. This work group is co-chaired by Glennis Edwall, director of our Children's Mental Health Division, Rick Paul, who's on staff with the SMDC Medical Center in Duluth. I didn't know what that was. You might remember it as Miller DeWan. It's got a new name now. And Mary Reagan from the Council of Child Caring Agencies here in the state. This group did an extensive series of listening sessions, going on-site and listening to families, service providers in more than 20 locations around the state, and also with the help of NAMI, did some online work soliciting input from parents across the state. Some of the recommendations that are coming forward out of this group is that it kind of affirmed a state role in providing a safety net for child and adolescents, but also a recommendation that in providing that safety net, we remain flexible in how that safety net is provided. Also, there's a recommendation to explore options for creating contract beds for children. You might know that we have a program called Contract Beds for Adults, where we provide operational subsidies for longer-term hospitalizations for adults in various community hospitalizations. This relieves some of the pressure on state-operated services, keeps people closer to where their homes are, and there was some interest in doing this for children and adolescents as well. Finally, another one of the recommendations that I thought I'd share with you was they have also been exploring the need to establish an intermediate level of care somewhere between acute care and our current children's residential treatment settings capacity in the state. There are a number of unanswered questions with CMS, and we're hoping now that CMS seems to have gotten its legs back under it after the transition in administrations, that we can clarify some of those questions before we move forward with that. Later in the document, I also supplied kind of a timeline for the actions of the task force. We began recruiting members in June 9th, shortly after the end of session last year. Had our first organizational meeting of the task force on June 22nd. During that time, we elected co-chairs, and I wanted to let you know that the co-chairs of the advisory task force have been Ed Idy with the Mental Health Association, Scott Griffey with AskMe, and Gwen Carlson from Hennepin County. They, along with my assistant commissioner, Reed Sulik, have been the four co-chairs. The four of them have met in between the meetings of the task force to kind of guide the agenda and structure the work of the task force as it has moved forward. And it's been my pleasure to support them in that. As you can see, we've been holding regular task force meetings over the summer and picked up the pace of them as we got into the fall here. And then finally, we will be meeting on December 6th to hopefully wrap up our work. And we'll have some further meetings if for some reason we aren't able to do it on Monday. But that's where we're at, and I wanted to make sure that you were up to date with all of that. Are there any other questions?
Thank you. I'd like to just go back to the information that you provided us regarding dental services. And perhaps this is just, I hope that I'm maybe misunderstanding this, but it seems as if there's a strong focus on reimbursement rates in that particular area and with the recommendation coming forward. And I don't think that it was the intent or the charge that be the focus of how to resolve that particular issue. And I wonder, and perhaps it's just not included here or can be included in the final recommendation or the final report, but clearly, I think without even having the group go back and review utilization data, it was very apparent that those services simply are not available in greater Minnesota. And so I'm hopeful that the work group will have honed in on that a little bit more closely and come up with some ideas that are going to provide some real solutions.
Yes, I don't think that Madam Chair, I don't believe that they're wholly focused on rates. They have other solutions, and certainly there's nothing coming out of this group that would interpret as recommendations for state-operated services to cease providing the dental services that they are. Only ways that I interpret using that resource as a possible means of, for instance, training other providers to better serve this population. There have also been some discussions regarding some of the relationships out in the western part of the state in the area served by the Prime West county-based purchasing area and things that they've done to improve access to dentistry. The focus here, I think, is split between what can we do with the resources that we have in SOS and what are some of the things that need to happen in the larger area. Obviously, any recommendations coming out of the group are advisory to both the commissioner and the legislature, and we have to pick and choose on what to take up and when's the right time to take those up.
Thank you. I think we're going to hear more specific information regarding ANOCA, but perhaps before we do that, you didn't mention, and I know that there was a lot of discussion in this division multiple times regarding the facility in Eveleth with regard to state-operated services, and I wondered if you might want to provide us with an update of what's happening there.
Madam Chair, I don't believe I'm the best person to do that. I maybe can get someone else from the department to do that. Thank
great.
You, Mike.
Mr. Tesner, welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Mike Tesner. I'm Chief Executive for State Operated Services. If you recall, last year, part of our effort to deal with the budget pressure included the closure of the Eveleth adult residential program. Out of that came legislation requiring us to do a number of different things. One was to work with the current owner in resolving our obligation around our lease arrangement The legislation offered up or provided funding for us to do that. Another was that we seek a variance from the CMS around locating a adult care foster transition site, which we will be operating inside the current structure, which the current structure is half of a nursing home. I think those were the two main items. We have been in conversation with both the city and the nursing home and now the local mental health center around the option of them taking on that property, reusing it for crisis services for the adult mental health population, and potentially some type of assisted living or nursing home expansion for the nursing home. There was a meeting up there this week that is forwarding those ideas, and they seem to be promising because it looks like everyone agrees that that's the direction we need to head and are working in that uniformly in that direction. I believe late summer we submitted a request to CMS for a variance around locating a foster site on the campus of in the immediate proximity of a nursing home. We have now received verification from CMS that that is not something that they would grant a variance on, which puts us into the next phase, which is instead of locating it in the residence on that site, we'll be locating it in the Eveleth community in a single-family residence. So we are now looking for housing, and we're pretty confident because of the availability of housing stock in those communities around Eveleth that we'll find that shortly.
Thank you. And I presume that that information has been clearly articulated to those stakeholders that it most directly affects. Mr. Tesner?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, the notice from CMS was just received, and there is a letter that's being formulated that will be going out. The committee chairs in the House Senate will get a copy of it, as well as the affected legislators, and that'll go out this week.
Thank you.
All right. Please continue.
Okay. Is it mine?
Yep.
I think we're going to hear from Mr. Anderson.
Yes, Madam Chair. I'll be talking about the transitioning of the Anoka Metro Regional Treatment Center. Excuse me. This is an effort that's aimed at reducing the capacity of the hospital by up to two different units. And correspondingly creating resources and services in the community to meet the needs of those individuals. I'll give you some background information on this and also maybe talk about just what has transpired up to now and what will be, what's planned to go on. There's some general principles that are guiding this work, and one is that we definitely need to focus on the needs of the challenging population that's being served. Many of them have complex medical needs, substance abuse, medical conditions, and challenging behaviors. And so as we look at having appropriate community services designed, we have to take that in mind and be responsive to that. The process needs to be inclusive of all interested stakeholders, including the task force that Mr. Allen was talking about earlier. The services are to be community-based services, and the overall process needs to be one in which it incents cooperation and collaboration between all the major stakeholders, such as the counties, community mental health providers, and the hospitals. And also the service alternative needs to employ state staff. The following activities have already happened or will happen. One is that we've had the formation of the task force, which Don talked about. We sent out on October 11th a request for information. To engage, and the effort was to engage the stakeholder counties in a dialogue about how they would like to see the system evolve and meet the needs of these clients. We received a number of letters back from stakeholders. We also received a letter from the counties asking additional questions after we sent out the RFI. And both the RFI and the letter from the counties and our response to the county letter are all contained in a packet you received. We've been in consultation with the task force all the way along, and that will continue because this is actually a part of that process as well. Also planned in December is a meeting with the counties to talk about the next steps, which is the drafting of a request for proposal. And we'll be soliciting input from the counties about just what should, from their point of view, what should go into that.
Mr. Anderson, I'm going to just stop it for a moment. Senator Lori.
Mrs. Chair, Mr. Anderson, we're talking about this legislation here, right, for ANOCA. So you sent out an RFI on October 11th?
Mr. Anderson.
Madam Chair,
when
Senator.
The transition was supposed to be, the plan for the transition was supposed to be completed by October 1st, it says in the legislation here, the instruction to you. I mean, and then...
Mr. Anderson.
Madam Chair, if I may. Senator Lori, in response to that, we had a couple of competing imperatives that we were dealing with. One, we needed to work with the Transformation Advisory Task Force and for them to cover enough material for them to feel that we had something to work with. But we also couldn't work with just a statewide group. We also had to involve the local region in these discussions. And the purpose of the RFI was then to take the kind of overarching principles that we had through our work with the task force and then get the local involvement in that. And so that's... the development of those overarching principles is what led to the lateness of the release of the RFI. But we felt we really had to get that local perspective involved, and we weren't getting that through the task force itself.
I think what Senator Lori is pointing out, that this has been a long time in coming.
Yes, we understand that.
Please continue, Mr. Anderson.
Ultimately, the goal is to roll out and implement the new services somewhere between the time period of June 2011 and the end of the year. And in order to do that thoughtfully, I guess we need the time to do that. And in fact, we've gotten considerable input and pushback from the counties about they believe that this is pretty breakneck in terms of needing to get this in such tight timelines, get this done within that time frame. And so the next step is to sit down with the counties and engage them in a conversation about the RFP. The RFP will be drafted and distributed by March 1 of this year, there'll be a turnaround, 60-day turnaround for March 1st or May 1st, 2011. And then we'll review that and we'll be notifying them, the responders of the successful RFP. And so that's, like I said, the goal is to get stage this so that they're ready to roll with something starting mid-year 2011 and with rollout by the end of the year.
Mr. Anderson, also contained in the legislation, and you know there was much discussion surrounding this also about the impact that this would have not only on the stakeholders involved, the clients and the patients, but on the employees. And I think it would be helpful for us to have an update on that provision as well.
The and we're cognizant of that, of course, and that's one of the givens that we're moving ahead on, Madam Chair. As the services get redefined, having state employees in the mix and providing the service is a requirement of that. And I don't know if I have anything more specific than that to say about it. It's just one of the driving principles.
Mr. Anderson, if I might, let me help. Okay. No layoffs. No layoffs. That's what the language says.
Sure. Madam Chair, we're aware of that. And the RFP and the RFI, the RFI reflected that, and so will the RFP. Madam Chair.
Thank you. Madam Chair.
Oh, you're back.
I'm sorry if I missed this, if you already talked about it, but when will we see actually the opening of new alternative delivery locations or services in each of the sites that we talked about during the session?
Madam Chair, the goal is to begin implementing mid-year in 2011 with full implementation before the end of the year.
Okay, then what I don't understand is we provided some one-time money to help with the startup costs of these new services. And if the new services aren't starting till mid-year 2011, then there won't be the startup money that we had appropriated to do the startup costs with.
Madam Chair, once again, I'm Mike Tessner with the Department of Human Services, State Operated Services. As Mr. Allen had testified to, our intent over the course of the summer was to get this planning moving more quickly than it was ultimately able to. We felt it was critically important that the task force and some of the early work they did had to occur so that it could shape our thinking around the engagement with stakeholders, with what type of process we would go through in order to get the counties and the array of other providers to the table planning for this transition. That has caused us to, when we put out the RFI in October, it was very clear that our intent was to get this running at that time, I think, during this fiscal year, which would have been before July 1st. The response we got back from the counties was they felt, as Mr. Anderson had testified, that was too fast, too much, too many unknowns. So we have, frankly, rethought our position on this and then come up with the second strategy, which is, as Mr. Anderson testified, beginning January, February, write the RFP, get it out so that the implementation can start by mid-year 2011.
I might just remind you that your own budget had called for some of these changes to take place in May of this year. So we thought giving you a little more time was a good idea, but you're taking a lot more time, is kind of how I'm looking at it.
Well, Madam Chair, without being defensive on this issue, when he did this transition in Greater Minnesota, one of the areas that we found wasn't as productive as we wanted it to be was active inclusion of all the different stakeholders, not just patients and their families, but also the hospitals, the jailers, the mental health centers, the axe and earths and arms providers. There were efforts made, but we didn't have them together in a uniform way describing how they would work with us in a collaborative fashion to better serve the folks that come to our door for care. So we are extremely intent in the redesign of the ANOCA system that it be done in collaboration with all these different stakeholders so that we don't have gaps in the system, so that people don't end up discharged from one facility and dropped.
ANOCA is one case. There are other sites as well. In the ANOCA case, all we're losing out on is housing money. I mean, I think that's a big deal, but, if people want to fool around and take longer and give up the housing money, then I guess that's the way it is. But at the other sites, you were talking about starting in May. And so let me ask you another question. For the other sites, has a state plan amendment gone in to get federal participation on other delivery models? Have you received approval of the state plan amendment?
Madam Chair, you're referencing the changes at Wilmer and Wadena,
mm-hmm.
I'm assuming.
And there were others as well, I think.
Yeah, here where the current status of that is we have received, we determined that we didn't at this point need a state plan amendment. We have received approval for a rate for the Wadena site, and that's in process, so that will be happening shortly. The Wilmer site would happen after that, probably January into February. The Brainerd program is the next one that we're anticipating. It will follow the rate approval, hopefully, for the from the Wilmer site. So we've begun that process. Wadena has been approved and will be happening shortly. The next one will be Wilmer, and then following that will be the new rehab services out of Brainerd.
And what about Mito?
We're currently in the redesign of Mito, looking at the license for that service. It's really distinctly different from the services out of the Wadena site or the Wilmer and the NeuroCog site out of Brainerd, primarily because of the developmental disability piece. So we're working now with licensing, with Disability Services Division, to determine the most appropriate license for that, as well as what type of certification might be available to offset the cost of operation. We don't today have an answer to that.
Then how will you, if you don't even have an answer for that right now, how will you be ready to start those new group home and or other services, housing services, by mid-year 2011?
Madam Chair, you're referencing the out of the Anoka redesign.
No, out of Mito.
Well, out of the Mito, what the redesign there is including an expansion of the community support services, which is this is the early intervention, the wraparound, the consultative services. And there are currently ways for those to be funded through the we'll just continue what we're already doing, funded through the waivered DD waiver services. The transitional foster sites will be funded through the waiver system, and we're anticipating those will be coming on probably after the first of the year. And then we'll be establishing an inpatient psychiatric capacity that out of the Anoka Hospital that will be serving folks with developmental disabilities and co-occurring mental illness. That's kind of the package of services that will be replacing Mito. The CSS funding piece is already in place. The transitional adult foster care funding piece is already in place for when those actually get running. What we don't have is the license and the type of certification or the way to fund the program on the Cambridge campus, and of course our ability to fund through medical assistance the services at Anoka is compromised because of the IMD status.
When will the foster homes for Mito be opening? Do you know where they'll be?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, we have one site already located. That will be opening after the first of the year, early January. We had some negotiation to do with our collective bargaining units around how to get staff from the Mito program and make those jobs available to them. That's in process, and we expect that will be done by the end of the month, and then we'll be able to open that first house. We're actively looking for housing for the second four-bed site, and both of these will be located in the immediate Cambridge proximity. And that second site is really dependent upon finding housing, but as I said earlier, around Eveleth, housing market right now is very good if you're looking for housing. So we anticipate having housing available sometime shortly after the first of the year, January, February, somewhere in there.
The second site would be near Eveleth?
I'm sorry. The second site would be in the Cambridge area. I was referencing some questions earlier about locating a transitional foster site in Eveleth, which we're actively pursuing as well.
So as far as you know, you're not going to need any transitional funding for Mito. You're not going to need any transitional funding for Wilmer or Wadena. And the issue is then how long it takes to get Anoka some redesign services functioning for Anoka clients. And the longer it takes, the more housing dollars we lose for other housing services for people that might leave Anoka.
Madam Chair, I think your description is accurate.
Are there other questions? Okay. Is there someone here from the Minnesota Veterans Homes? Pam Barrows?
Good morning, Madam Chair and members of the committee. I'm Pam Barrows. I'm the Senior Director for Veterans Health.
And excuse my voice, I'm rather hoarse. I'm Amy Rudolph with the department also.
I'm here to share with you a bit of background information regarding the allegations of retaliation at the Veterans Home in Hastings. First, the home is in the midst of an internal investigation. And because of that, we're not able to share very much information at this time. But as soon as that, as the findings of the report are completed, we would be happy to share with you what we do find. And second, and very importantly, we want to assure you that the Minnesota Veterans Homes have zero tolerance for any behavior involving retaliation. We take all offenses of this nature very seriously. And we remain committed to providing the highest care possible for our Minnesota veterans. What we can share, and basically what you're receiving is a letter that was sent to our stakeholders. I'll just summarize what's in that letter. In July of 2010, the U.S. Department of Veterans Affairs conducted a survey at the Hastings Veterans Home. Pretty typical, normal survey, but again, it was a little bit out of time frame for when they would normally do that. But following that, the home received a copy of the survey. Although that survey showed that the team had interviewed residents and staff about the concern of retaliation, they did not substantiate any of those allegations, nor at their verbal exit did they indicate anything extremely serious or to that intent. As we normally would with any survey, we develop a corrective action plan, return that to the VA. They review that, and in September of 2010, they accepted our corrective action plan and sent the Hastings Veterans Home a letter of full compliance. We met all their standards. and that meant that we were certified and we would continue to receive our per diem from the USDVA. In October, following the implementation of the corrective action plan, The home received a letter from Senator Franken that included a memo from the VA, the same group that apparently did the survey substantiating retaliation. We were not aware of that, and we had not received a copy of this memo from the VA until it was forwarded us from Senator Franken.
Is the nature of the allegations surrounding not being able to access adequate medical care, is that what the allegations are about?
Basically, I think the retaliation involving the director of nursing in care from some of the residents. After receiving the memo, we took immediate action, additional action by launching our own internal investigation. The director of nursing, the administrator, and his assistant were placed on administrative leave. We wanted to make sure that staff and residents felt that they were open and free to share any thoughts. We wanted it to be very transparent. We also took additional immediate steps to make sure that the quality of the care at home was the way we wanted it to be. Some of the things that we've done, we did mandatory special training on resident rights, on the Vulnerable Adult Act, and specific facility policies. We rewrote and updated the home's grievance policy, made sure the residents were aware of it, and provided more staff training on grievance. We continued a self-administration medication policy that had been recently implemented and well received by residents. And we're continuing to move towards a resident-centered care model that promotes resident choice and resident participation in determining how their care will be delivered. Again, as the Department of Veterans Affairs, we take the VA's findings very seriously. We're working quickly to address and resolve any issues. As I mentioned earlier, we have zero tolerance for any behaviors and actions relating to retaliation in any of our homes. And our top priority has been and will continue to be to provide the highest quality care for all of the residents of all of our homes and to ensure that both our residents and our staff are treated with respect and dignity that they deserve. When the investigation is done, and hopefully it should be within the next couple of weeks, we would be happy to provide more information.
So I didn't really understand the answer to my question about what is the nature of the alleged retaliation.
The letter from Senator Franken, apparently what the VA said that they substantiated was that the residents felt that the director of nursing behaved in a manner that was retaliatory if they complained about their care. So it was a
retaliatory
perception.
Retaliatory in what way? You're answering my question by answering it with the same question I'm asking.
It was not real specific. That's the problem.
That's why we're doing the investigation right now.
Yeah, it was not and it's been a while. I apologize. I read the letter probably about a month ago, and I have not read it since. But
so you don't know if she was verbally abusive or if she was withholding services?
No, I don't know that it was withholding services or verbally abusive. I think it was a perception that the residents, if they complained about anything, they might have what they felt were their rights taken away. That was kind of the perception we got, and that's why we're doing the investigation to find out exactly what's real and what's not. And because again, we take it very, very seriously. If they perceive that, we need to correct that perception, even if it, you know, we need to make sure that they live in an atmosphere that doesn't create fear.
If the United States Department of Veterans Affairs substantiated the retaliation, they must have given you some information about what kind of retaliation they thought was taking place.
At this point, they've not been able to clearly define any specifics.
Any other questions? Senator Lynch.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Berglund, it indicates here that it was in October of 2010 that the Hastings home was received word via Senator Franken's office of the USDVA finding. In what way was that information conveyed to this committee, to this division?
I think that was
in October.
I heard about it in the news. I don't think we received a letter informing
Madam
us.
Chair, and I apologize, we did send the a copy of the letter that you have to both the Senate and House Ag and Senate Committee, and we apologize that we did not send it to this committee.
Madam Chair.
Senator Lynch.
And I realize that Mr. Acevedo is apparently not with us today, but perhaps this message could be taken back, because we've had this discussion with him repeatedly when the homes have been before the division before. And we have, this is unfortunately not the first situation that, frankly, members of this committee find out about actions at the Minnesota Veterans Homes, and we find out about it through the newspaper. That is not acceptable. Not today, not ever. This cannot continue to happen. This division is responsible for a good part of your funding and oversight. And as such, that communication has to be more clearly articulated going forward.
You can tell Gil, I'm sure he hasn't forgotten about me. Your questions?
Madam Chair, I guess you're talking about the fact that you're continuing to investigate this. This is something that you've been at least apprised of for 6 months now. After 6 months, you're still not sure exactly what the nature of the complaint is. And so, pardon me, but I'm feeling like I'm not leaving here very comfortable that there's going to be some resolution to this matter. So I'm just wondering sort of what the next step is, or what the time frame is, or when and how that will be communicated with this division.
Madam Chair, Senator, and it's not been 6 months. We didn't find out about the substantiated, what the VA said was substantiated, until into October, and immediately launched an investigation at that point, and which should be resolved within the, like I said, within the next week.
Will we be expecting to hear back from you in a week then about what the outcome of the investigation is?
Madam Chair, as soon as the investigation is done, we will respond back to you what the outcome is and any changes that have been incorporated. Yes, ma'am.
Other questions? We'll look forward to hearing from you then. Thank you very much for being here today.
Thank you.
With that, the meeting is adjourned. Before we do that, however, I want to say, since this is our last committee meeting, we thank our staff who worked very hard for us over this past biennium, both our partisan and nonpartisan staff, because they are the ones that really make it possible for us to have accomplished all that we've been able to do. So And to Dave especially, since he's retiring, a wealth of knowledge and skills that we're going to very, very much miss. Good luck to you, though. And to those of you that will not be back on the committee, we wish you the best in your future endeavors. And to those of you who will be back, we wish you the best in a very difficult situation. With that, the meeting's adjourned.